A municipal court judge in Bergen County, New Jersey, allows a misconduct complaint against Governor Chris Christie to proceed. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Phil Gregory reports that it's in connection with the September 2013 lane closures along the George Washington Bridge.
Retired Teaneck firefighter Bill Brennan claims Christie knew about the lane closures as they happened and failed to stop it. Assemblyman John Wisniewski co-chaired the legislative committee that investigated the bridge scandal. He says the citizen complaint now goes to the county prosecutor.
It's a black eye for the state to have this determination made. It's embarrassing. It certainly corroborates the suspicions that many people have had, but we have to wait for the developments to play out.
Governor Christie insists he had no knowledge of the lane realignments before or during the closures. The governor's office says it will appeal the municipal judge's ruling. A Christie spokesman calls it a dishonorable complaint filed by a political activist with a history of abusing the judicial system. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Candidates in Pennsylvania's only competitive U.S. congressional race faced off in Bucks County today. In the second of their two debates, Republican Brian Fitzpatrick, a former FBI agent, and Democrat Steve Santacero, a state representative, agreed on several issues. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that the mostly civil exchange, though, ended on a sour note with a quarrel about who's the bigger insider.
In this election cycle, the label of career politician may be the biggest insult. Over an hour into the 8th District congressional debate, Fitzpatrick called his opponent just that.
If you want to know the biggest difference between the two candidates on the stage right now, one is a career politician, and the other spent his career arresting politicians.
Santacero shot back, saying Fitzpatrick is the epitome of a rigged system that benefits those with powerful connections.
I mean, Brian, the reality is you wouldn't be running for this seat if your brother were not the congressman. You would not have been given the Republican nomination. That's just the reality.
That pointed exchange and some comments about Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump were largely in contrast to the 75-minute debate's subdued tone. This week, Fitzpatrick distanced himself from his party's presidential pick, saying he won't vote for either major party candidate. Santacero says he should have denounced Trump a long time ago. As for where they stand on issues, the wide-ranging conversation at Bucks County Community College's Bristol campus touched on a number. First up was taxes. Santacero says working families are crushed by unfair tax codes that favor the wealthy. Fitzpatrick agrees.
Our Internal Revenue Code is a convoluted mess. It's loaded with special interest loopholes. It needs to end.
Both support major investment in infrastructure to create jobs, though they differ on how to fund it. And both are against mass deportation of undocumented immigrants and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One major difference is what to do about the deal struck with Iran over nuclear weapons. Santacero says honor it. Fitzpatrick says scrap it. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
Having and raising kids is expensive, and early on, perhaps the most costly part is paying someone to care for them while parents are at work. During this year's presidential election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have released plans to ease that burden. WHYY's Aaron Mozell dug into the candidates' proposals and what they'd mean for struggling parents.
Coconut.
Here, let's check this out. Sit down.
I'm sitting right here.
It's just after 6 o'clock, dinner time at Michi Hunt and John Mosca's house in South Philly. 3-year-old Nori is digging into a coconut yogurt and some baby carrots. Her 4-month-old sister, Aiko, has already filled up on milk. The adults are having sausage, red peppers, and rice at some point.
I really would love for us to, like, have this moment where we all sit down, but it's mostly, like, getting her fed, and then we try to get her to bed, and then we can eat. And this one she can eat anytime, so.
Besides, they have bigger fish to fry when it comes to raising their daughters, like paying for childcare for both of them. Hunt says that eats up nearly a third of their annual household income. The couple brings home roughly $70,000 after taxes.
It's jaw-dropping.
Like, we both have a college degree. We both have jobs, reasonably good jobs. I'm not doing something outrageous.
Nori goes to daycare full-time, 5 days a week. Aiko goes for 3. To make it work to pay for childcare and everything else, the mortgage, groceries, clothes, Hunt and Mosca do what you'd expect. They pinch pennies.
With one, it really, really squeezed us financially. With two, it feels like you know, like you're stealing, but what is it? Borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. Like you're sort of like, oh, well, we're just going to rack up some credit debt. I mean, there's no two ways about it.
Hunt and Mosca aren't alone. In most counties in Pennsylvania, childcare is the single biggest expense for families, more than rent and nearing or surpassing college tuition at a public university. Carol Austin is executive director of the Delaware Valley Association for the Education of Young Children. She says that's a big problem.
For me, it's at a breaking point. I know it's at a breaking point here in Pennsylvania. I dread to think that we'll start just warehousing kids.
But paying for childcare could become easier. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have plans for making it more affordable. Let's start with Clinton's plan. She wants to help parents by improving the country's childcare system. Here she is at a campaign stop in Kentucky covered by Fox News.
A lot of the stress is because it's so expensive on childcare that they don't feel like they're putting anything away for later education. So
under Clinton's proposal, the cost of childcare would be capped at 10% of a family's income. For Hunt and Mosca, that means they could save up to $17,000 a year. Hunt says they currently shell out $24,000.
It would be amazing. That would be great. Even better would for it to be free.
Now let's look at Trump's plan. He wants to allow parents to deduct the cost of childcare from their taxes.
Because of the way the benefit is capped and structured, our plan will bring relief to working and middle-class families. Importantly, our policy also supports mothers who choose to stay at home and honors and recognizes their incredible contributions to their families and to our society.
Trump wants to give parents the ability to scrap the full amount of child care from their federal income taxes. That total can't be more than the average cost of care in your state. After getting some flack for not addressing poor families, his plan now includes an earned income tax credit for low-income families. They wouldn't benefit much from an income tax deduction because they're not putting up a lot of income to begin with. Trump's plan would bring down Hunt and Mosca's annual childcare costs nearly $3,000 to roughly $21,000 a year. Jamie Hopkins is a professor at the American College of Financial Services. He says neither plan will make childcare significantly cheaper for anyone who is struggling to afford it now.
That's still going to be a burden, whether these plans are in place or not. It might help ease some of that burden.
Hopkins' point rings especially true for low-income parents, like Stacy Booker. She lives in Ambler in Montgomery County, about 20 minutes from the Philadelphia border, with her 2-year-old daughter, Leia. Booker is a single mom and brings home roughly $1,400 a month after working 2 part-time jobs. One is at a senior home, the other at a rehab center. Booker technically lives above the poverty line, but not by much.
It's extremely hard. Sometimes I'm surprised I don't have a nervous breakdown or I'm not strung out on hardcore drugs or I'm a severe alcoholic.
Childcare is subsidized, but it still accounts for up to a third of Booker's monthly income, depending on the time of year. She's working towards a nursing degree, but school's out in the summer. She doesn't get the subsidy on days she's off work and school, and that happens more often then. But
you really have no choice because you have to pay your mortgage to have a place to live, but then I have to pay for childcare in order for my daughter to be in a school environment and for me to be able to go to work and go to school.
Experts say neither Trump nor Clinton's plan would be cheap or easy to implement, at least with the details out now. But Jamie Hopkins, the finance professor, says while they're expensive, both plans are realistic. That has parents across the country feeling hopeful that their budgets could be a little less stressed, even if their days are still hectic. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Of the 692 minors waived into New Jersey's adult criminal justice system within the past 5 years, almost 90% were Black or Latino. One of the findings from an investigative study conducted by WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez, her 5-part series entitled Kids in Prison, Racial Disparities, Longer Sentences, and a Better Way sheds light on the disparity and contrasts New Jersey's approach with a much different practice in Germany. Sarah, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Let's also get perspective from Marsha Levick, Deputy Director and Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, which she co-founded in 1975. Marsha, welcome back to NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Sarah, though you focus specifically on New Jersey, let's note that all states allow minors to be prosecuted as adults.
The reason why I went to Germany is because originally when we started this reporting project, I knew that I wanted to go to a place that didn't allow minors to be prosecuted as adults. And when I called researchers and advocacy groups, they all told me that there wasn't a state that protects minors from adult prisons or adult convictions. If I wanted to find that system, I would have to leave the country.
Part one of your series is entitled Kids in Prison: Getting Tried as an Adult Depends on Skin Color. And we learn about Jamal, who was first brought into that system at age 14. That system and the process is really reliant on merely two people, the prosecutor and a judge.
In New Jersey, minors who commit crimes don't have to be tried as adults, no matter what the crime is. It's up to the prosecutor in a particular county to ask a judge to say, hey, I would like to treat this child as an adult. And then a judge has to approve that request. Then that kid is transferred into the adult criminal justice system. They start their court process all over again in the adult system as opposed to the family court system. If they did get a prison sentence in New Jersey, that meant that they would end up in an adult prison. And adult sentences are a lot longer than juvenile sentences.
You did cite a new New Jersey law whereby minor offenders are housed at least until age 18 in a juvenile facility.
Yeah, so starting in March of this year, minors can no longer be placed in adult prisons. So they have to at least start their prison sentences in a juvenile facility. And they could, based on good behavior, they could stay there well into their 20s. They could finish their sentence there. But all of the young people who are currently in adult prisons, they don't benefit from this new law. The law's not retroactive.
And of those 692 minors, you've noted that most of them committed robberies.
We got data on how many times did a prosecutor in every county in New Jersey ask to try a kid as an adult and how many times were those requests approved. And we know the race and ethnicity of each of those kids, and we have the breakdown by county. Then we looked at how many of those kids are actually still in prison. And of the kids, in both cases, of the kids who are still in prison, more than 90% of them are also Black or Latino. It really does come down to the prosecutor. If the prosecutor doesn't ask to try a kid as an adult, it does not happen. Camden County, for example, 68% of the requests that the prosecutor made in Camden County were approved by the judge. If you look at the requests to waive white kids, it was 31%, so 68 versus 31%. So in a couple of these counties, Black kids are getting transferred into the adult criminal justice system twice as likely or more than white kids, and in some counties than Latino kids too.
Marsha Levick, is what Sarah is describing align with what, essentially with what you see in Pennsylvania and indeed other states?
Two particular points stand out for me. One is, of course, the racial disparities that Sarah identified, and these are pervasive in our justice system across the country. With respect to the transfer mechanism in New Jersey, here in Pennsylvania and in other states across the country, we have multiple ways for trying kids as adults. So we have prosecutors who can make motions to have kids tried as adults, but we also have direct file or legislative waiver here in Pennsylvania. And what that means is actually it's not up to the prosecutor. The legislature simply carved out categories of both offenders, so juveniles who were 15 years or older, and categories of offenses. Murder had always been excluded, but other violent felonies, aggravated assault, rape, robbery, for example, and simply automatically requires that those cases be prosecuted in the criminal justice system. Now, in Pennsylvania, those kids who are subject to what we call direct file, they still have the opportunity to ask the criminal court judge to send their cases back to juvenile court. And that happens roughly 40 to 50% of the time here in Philadelphia. Cases do go back to juvenile court. But there are about 15 states that function very similarly to New Jersey, where it's really prosecutor-driven. In states that have the direct file or legislative exclusion system that I described here in Pennsylvania, they don't all have reverse waiver.
And Sarah, in the course of examining alternate systems, you went across the ocean to Germany.
In Germany, anyone who commits a crime under age 21 can be treated as a juvenile, meaning they go to juvenile facilities, not adult prisons. They say that there's nothing about the age of 18 that means you're emotionally or mentally ready for adult prisons or adult consequences. And even people up to age 24 can benefit from this.
Were you able to then get numbers regarding rehabilitation, recidivism, contrasting Germany and, say, New Jersey?
In Germany, officials there told me that about 30% of their juveniles and young adults who do go to prison will come back within 3 years, so a third of them. But in the United States, more than 85% of people under age 24 who go to prison will get rearrested within 4 years. And New Jersey is about the same.
Marcia, let me put to you, do you have cause for optimism?
There are pockets of optimism. The Supreme Court sentencing cases that have recognized as a matter of constitutional law that kids are developmentally different, that we can't treat them the same as adults, I think is something that has been used effectively to eradicate the harshest sentences that kids have experienced. I'm hopeful that we can use those decisions to push back against even the very long terms of year sentences that we see still for kids in our justice system.
Marcia, thanks again for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Marcia Levick is Deputy Director and Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center. Sarah Gonzalez, thanks for being here as well.
Of course.
WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez, her five-part series can be accessed at WNYC.org. You can hear much more of our conversation at NewsWorks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at NewsWorks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.